Let's turn in our book of Judges to chapter 17, spiritual infidelity. That's what this chapter is somewhat about, mostly about. So it talks about spiritual infidelity. Infidelity, of course, is unfaithfulness, being unfaithful to a promise, unfaithful to the one promised to. Spiritual infidelity is being unfaithful to God. Idolatry is what we can call it. Idolatry is what this chapter is about with a man named Micah. Now, there was a man from the mountains of Ephraim whose name was Micah. And he said to his mother, "The 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from you and on which you put a curse, even saying it in my ears, here is the silver with me, I took it." And his mother said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my son." Now, it's an unusual thing. We just start off this chapter. It's not related in any way to Samson's story. It has nothing to do with anything. It just seems to throw this thing in. But what it's going to show us is how the nation of Israel spiraled out of control into spiritual infidelity, which would ultimately bring about the destruction of the nation. Would it bring about the bad events that we've already been studying about? In fact, some believe these chapters could very well be at the beginning of the book of Judges, rather than in a chronological order. Regardless, we can look at this and see that this is where the invitation of idolatry may have come into this section of the children of Israel. There's no question that this is part of the reason why idolatry came in so quickly, especially in the northern kingdom. The situation is this: a mother lost 1,100 shekels, lost her money. She believed it was stolen, and so she pronounced a curse. Whoever took that money, curse on that person who took the money. Well, her own son took the money. And so he's going, oh, the curse. She cursed the one who took it. So he's trying to, out of the fear of the curse, trying to make things right. Now, here's a man who did not fear the Lord. In fact, that's how we find ourselves getting in trouble, is when we fail to fear the Lord or to honor the Lord. When we don't respect him, we'll do anything because we don't believe he's going to do anything against us, or that there is a consequence for a sin because God doesn't give us evil for the evil we may do. And so we seem to disrespect him in this case, or not fear him in the right way. To fear the Lord means that I understand that he is there and he's watching my life and that I want to live my life to please him. That's the fear of the Lord. Living your life to please God. That's the fear of the Lord. It tells us that's really where wisdom begins. Wisdom can't even get started in our life until we acknowledge that one thing: God is watching my life. He knows everything that I do, and therefore I want to live my life to honor him. Here's a man who didn't care to honor God. However, he wanted to be religious, as we're going to see. So he was concerned more with the curse. And so he brought the money back. He said, it was me, I took it. And his mother said, well, bless you, my son. Not curse you, but bless you. So in a sense, she sought to neutralize the curse. Neutralizing the curse. Whatever curse I put on you, well, I'm blessing you now, and I'm putting a blessing. So if there's a curse that follows, the blessing will overtake it, and this seems to make everything all right. So when he had returned the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother said, I had wholly dedicated the silver from my hand to the Lord for my son to make a carved image and a molded image. Now, therefore, I will return it to you. Now, do you see the conflict here? Here we see a good intention. I have wholly dedicated the money to the Lord. And here it says Jehovah. You see the word Lord is in capital letters, which implies Jehovah or Yahweh. I have dedicated the money to the God of Israel. That's what she's saying here. And therefore, I want to make a molded image. I want to make a carved image or a molded image, a fashion some type of statue or something that I can honor God with, that I can think of God with. Now, this becomes a problem. Some might say that, they went out and carved some, false god. It's very possible that she may have wanted to fashion something to help her to remember Jehovah. It's not necessarily saying that she made a golden calf, or she made a statue to Dagon, or she made a statue to some other god. It's possible that she wanted to honor Jehovah and built something to remember Jehovah by. But that's a problem, isn't it? That was forbidden by God to do so. Yet, she wanted to honor the Lord. Now, this is what often happens in our good intentions. And you know the saying, good intentions pave the road to hell. And we have all good intentions of what we hope to accomplish, what we really want to do, but then we undo the whole thing. It's kind of like, I want to study the Bible so much, so I go out and steal all the Bibles I can in order to study it. It doesn't make sense. It's illogical that I can justify my spiritual conviction with something that's spiritually wrong. But that's what these people did. This family acted that way, and it all trickles down. The mom was messed up in her thinking. So guess what? Her son Micah, oh man, he was tweaked. He has got a problem. He's got a real spiritual problem, partly stemming from a spiritual pride. And what this is a man who doesn't want to do it God's way. That's what spiritual infidelity is about. I'll believe in God, but I'm going to believe in God my way. And we begin to make up the rules as we go, make up our own religion as we go. And I think there's probably a good many of us in this room who understand exactly what I'm talking about. I used to be like that. Being raised in the Catholic Church, I understood various aspects of God, various aspects of religion. I understood it. But in my youth and in my pride, I said, well, I know I believe in God, but I believe in this, that, or the other thing. Well, I don't know where I got that. It just was my own opinion. I just grabbed it out of the sky, and I said, I'm going to believe in this, and I'm going to believe in that too. And I just decided to kind of throw everything together in my life. By what authority do I have to do something like that? We call it like cafeteria religion. You know, cafeteria, you go up to the counter and you take your tray and you walk through and you say, I'll take some of this and I'll take some of that. And I don't like that stuff. I'll leave that and I'll take some of this. When we get to the end, we say, there, now cash it in. How much do I owe? But we have created for ourselves our own meal by our own likes, our own desires. And when we apply this to religion, to true spirituality, somehow we think it's going to hold up. That's spiritual pride, to think that we can invent a religion, that we can invent something that's supposed to be honored by everyone else. And then you go in to talk to someone. Someone will come up to you and you say, well, I have my own religion. Oh, really? What is it? Let me hear it. And they begin to tell you the religion. And they expect you to honor that. Where do you get that religion? Well, it's just my own beliefs. So? You just can't do that. And that's precisely what this fella Micah is going to do. Starting with the mom, she went out, dedicated this to the Lord, but did something that violated the Lord, violated his law. Thus he returned the silver to his mother. Then his mother took 200 shekels of silver and gave them to the silversmith, and he made it into a carved image and a molded image, and they were in the house of Micah. The man Micah had a shrine and made an ephod and household idols, and he consecrated one of his sons who became a priest. He's got the whole package now. You see, we're going to be a religion. We kind of have to have all of the things that go with a religion. He's actually building now a rival religion to the religion of the Jews. Something that was going to rival it. We're going to find out at the end of chapter 18 that the temple of God was in Shiloh at this time. That's where they were supposed to go to worship. But now what this man had done is he's established a shrine. A shrine. It's no longer just for his house. Now he's built a shrine and invites people to come and worship at the shrine. We don't have to go all the way to Shiloh. Look, I've got all these things here. I even have a priest now. Who's the priest? Well, my son is the priest. Where did he get his training? Well, it's not about training. I've given him the authority to be the priest. Well, who are you? You don't have the authority to make him a priest. But this is precisely where religion comes from. Precisely where false religions occur. And many of them have started with similar bizarre stories. They've started with visions of crosses on the battlefield. Or they started with supernatural magic glasses. Or they've started through various types of inventions of men or visions of demons to cause them to go down a road that would be a rival to the true faith in Christ. And so this man sets up his own religion, consecrated one of his sons who became this priest. How does he do this? Well, verse 6 tells you, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. We have one word that describes that today. It's called relativism. Relativism is the teaching that there are no absolutes. In other words, what is right for one is not necessarily right for another. That's why we see the debate in our world today versus the world versus Christian morals. Christian morals provides for us, in a sense, absolutes. Here are the absolutes. The absolute is God said, you shall not. Well, relativism says there are no absolutes. You shall not. But that doesn't mean I shall not. Because everyone does what is right in their own eyes. You know, we think of our world today and we think, oh, we're just getting so bad. We're getting so bad. It's just a repeat of history. What is happening is we don't learn from our badness of the past. And we continually reject the absolute love of God and the absolute right way of God. And because we're constantly rejecting that, in a sense, history repeats itself. Judgment, punishment, discipline, consequence. All of these things because we reject God's way. And here is a man who knew God's way, a woman who believed in Jehovah, but set up an altar, set up an idol, build an idol, fashion an idol. What blacksmith could she go to, or silversmith could she go to, where she would be able to have a guy make an idol? Was he a Jew? Was he a Jewish silversmith? Or was he a pagan silversmith? Where does she go to have this done? Somewhere there's a problem with the people of Israel. And what it was is everyone was doing what was right in his own eyes. There was no king. What's the idea of a king? You see, this is actually not necessarily true. There was a king, the King of Kings. It was Jehovah. God wanted to be their king. But the idea of a king is there was no one to say right from wrong. Here is, in a sense, there was no established government for them other than the law of Israel, the law of God. It's the only law that existed at that time. And what they were saying is, we don't want that law. We want a king. Later on, they're going to say, we want a king to rule over us, not just this. And Samuel would become very upset with that. So would God, because they would choose man's rule over God's rule. And here, everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Now there was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah. He was a Levite and was staying there, a Levite. He was a priest, a man who knew the law, a man who knew what God's word was about, what God expected. And he was staying there in this time when all these idols were being made. The man departed from the city of Bethlehem in Judah to stay wherever he could find a place. Then he came to the mountains of Ephraim, to the house of Micah, as he journeyed. What is this? It sounds like it's a seminary student looking for a good gig. He just wants to know, where can I serve? Where can I be of help? Where can I minister? Well, a Levite was supposed to stay in the city of the Levites. He was really out of bounds here. He shouldn't have been where he was heading, and yet that's where he went nonetheless. And consequently, he gets himself in trouble. Micah said to him, where do you come from? So he said to him, well, I'm a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, and I am on my way to find a place to stay. Micah said to him, well, dwell with me and be a father and a priest to me, and I will give you 10 shekels of silver per year, a suit of clothes, and your sustenance. So the Levite went in. Then the Levite was content to dwell with the man, and the young man became like one of his sons to him. Interesting. There are a couple of reasons why a person goes into the ministry. Maybe three reasons. There probably is more, but I'll just talk about three. One is because he senses the call of God upon his life. And he can't see himself doing anything but serving God with all of his life. Another is for money. Peter writes about that, and he said, care, shepherd the flock of God over whom God has made you overseers. And he said, not for money's sake, for filthy money, not for blood money in a sense. Don't do it for bad money. Don't do it for the sake of money. So a person can serve God for money, financial reasons, security, in the same way that a man might pursue a career. He goes out and tries to find that which is going to provide needs for his household. Doesn't matter what he does, so long as it's a good amount of money that I can take care of my kids, send them to college, do what I have to do. So he seeks it as a career. And then there's another who would go into the ministry because he wants to feel wanted. There's an emotional need in him. He's insecure. He has no real following. No one really acknowledges him. No one really notices him. Notice that Micah touches on those two. Dwell with me and be a father and a priest to me. And you can see him, me? Be your father and your priest? And then he said, all right, I'll throw in 10 shekels of silver per year and a suit of clothes, and I'll take care of all of your food, your sustenance. Now there's the money aspect. The emotional aspect, you can be a priest, a father, me. You know, they never recognized me back at the seminary. They never thought I was good enough. They always gave me the grunt jobs. They always gave me the bad jobs. So I left, looking for a place where I can be more useful. And suddenly, here comes this wonderful offer. And he took it. All the clothes I need, the money I need, the food I need. So the Levite went in. And the Levite was content to dwell with the man. Verse 12, so Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest and lived in the house of Micah. Then Micah said, now I know that the Lord will be good to me since I have a Levite as a priest. Do you see? It's a superstitious thing he's done here. He's covered all the bases. He believes in Jehovah. He's got his statues that he prays to, his idols. Oh, and he has a priest too now. So he's got the full package. He consecrated the priest himself. What does that mean? Probably means he signed the contract and gave him his first payment. That's all he can do. For there's no power in Micah to pass on the consecration. You're either called of the Lord to do the work or you're not. And no amount of seminary training, no amount of studying, no amount of good deeds is going to call you into the ministry. If God doesn't call you, then you are not going to be successful or fruitful in the ministry. It's as simple as that. But here, this man really fulfills what Jesus called a hireling. In John chapter 10, Jesus talked about the hireling. The hireling doesn't really care about the flock. He's really there primarily to feed his own self, to pad his pockets. That's all that he's caring about. This man doesn't have the spiritual calling or capacity to watch over men. Now, maybe I'm being hard on the guy. Maybe he has good intentions. But he's just become the priest over idols. And he knows better than that. Surely we can excuse Micah. So far away from where God's people are being taught. Surely we can excuse the old lady, the mother. Maybe she's just a silly woman. She didn't understand it. Well, surely we can excuse all of that. But a Levite? There had to be some evil motive in his heart. And I would like to say to you, if you have an evil motive in your heart, then don't get into the ministry. Ministry is about the people. Ministry has to be about helping God's people find God, helping God's people understand God, helping God's people in serving him and living for him. That's really what the ministry is about, serving others. And it's not about padding your pockets. Chapter 18 is about social immorality. In those days, and it's continuing this story, that's why we'll put them together tonight. In those days, there was no king in Israel. And in those days, the tribe of the Danites was seeking an inheritance for itself to dwell in. For until that day, their inheritance among the tribes of Israel had not fallen to them. Now, a couple of things here. In those days, there was no king. This is the second time it's mentioned, and before we get through tonight, we'll see it again. There was no king. They keep saying that, but the idea here is a contrast. They had God ruling over them. But the implication is, well, if there was a king, the people wouldn't have behaved this way. Do you know what I mean? That's called being a man pleaser. Christians are warned in the New Testament not to be pleasers of men. A man pleaser is someone who looks over his shoulder to see who's watching or to make sure someone's watching. A man pleaser looks over his shoulder to see who's watching or to make sure someone is watching. Do you understand the difference? In other words, if I know someone's watching me, well, I won't do the evil thing that I was just thinking of doing. And so I'll not do it. But if that man wasn't standing there, I would have done the evil, which means I do not fear God, I fear the man. Do you see the difference there? Or I want to make sure someone's watching me, which tells me I want them to see my good works. I want them to see how spiritual I am. I want them to see that I'm a good person. And so I do it to please the man. But I really have no regard to the fact that I want to please God. And so my life should be one that says, I don't care who's watching me. God is watching me, and that's enough for me. That takes care of personal integrity. That takes care of accountability. Have you ever had someone come to you and say, I want to be accountable to you. I want you to hold me accountable. Have you ever heard someone do that? And I know sometimes there are certain things that we may have to do that in, especially when it tells us in Scripture, you know, to bear one another's burdens. That's a good place to go to and say, look, I'm struggling in this area of my life, and I need someone to help me out. Hold me accountable to that. I don't have a problem with that. Or when someone comes and says, you need someone to hold you accountable. Man, I run away from that sort of thing. I run away from it because I have to tell you something. I can easily fool man. Easily. Any one of us, we can fool anybody. Anybody. You know why? Because we're deceitful and desperately wicked in our hearts. Every one of us are. And if there's a way to get around you, I will. And you will. Because that's what we do. That's what we do. Ask my wife. I've asked her to hold me accountable in my dieting. And it's just not a good thing. So I got rid of the scale. It's true, we don't have one today for that very reason. Because I live for God. I'm not a man pleaser. Let's please God. Let's live to please God. God's watching. Don't worry about looking over your shoulder to see if man's watching. That's irrelevant. God's watching. And in those days, the tribe of the Danites was seeking an inheritance. What do you mean they were seeking an inheritance? They got their inheritance. Everybody got their inheritance. By this time, the inheritance was doled out to everybody, including the people of Dan. The problem is that they were not content with their inheritance, first of all. And second of all, there were previous inhabitants in the land that they didn't have the faith to drive out and overcome. So to them, instead of dealing with the problem there, they ran away. They ran away from their problem. They ran away from their situation. And they wanted to go find a place where they didn't have all this mess and all this. It's just too hard. All this is too hard. Let's just go find an easier way. And that sounds like us today, too. We all want to find an easy way. Going back to the diet thing, I'm sorry, I'm picking out. I'm terrible with it. I'm terrible. I hate it. I hate the talk of diet. I hate doing it. I hate being overweight. I hate the whole thing. I can't stand any of it. It just drives me crazy. But in some ways, it has to be done in my life. It has to be done. And so I have to constantly stay on top of it. And it drives me crazy. As I'm talking about this, I completely forgot my point. But it was a good one. Good. Then I don't have to talk about it. They were not content with what God had already given them. And in essence, they were looking for something else and rejecting God's inheritance, God's gift of the land. There was too much in. Oh, that's what I was going to say. Instead, we want every diet that I hear of, they always include the one non-negotiable thing, exercise. I hate that part. I hate that part. So I avoid the whole issue just because of that. I avoid it. I don't like exercise. My exercise is getting up and down from the table. That's as much as I can handle in a day. I'm not boasting. I'm confessing. I'm confessing. Yeah. Well, these people were just not willing to do what was necessary for them to obtain what God has given them. And it sounds like many Christians. For many Christians spend a lot of our time, we spend a lot of our time looking for what God has already given to us. A lot of our time searching, and I can't tell you how many Christians I've talked with, shared with, counseled with, Christians who say, well, there's just something missing in my life, and I don't know what it is. And they go looking for this something. They're always searching for something. When they know that Jesus is the answer for their life, they'll even tell you, well, I know Jesus is the answer, but there's something missing. There's something more. And instead of finding their contentment in Christ, instead of being pleased with knowing God, with knowing Christ and serving Him, there's always something more that they're searching for, and these poor people are miserable. And they find out, just like the children of Dan, the Danites here, they went searching, and they're going to find trouble. What they found was trouble. So the children of Dan sent 5 men of their family from their territory, men of valor from Zorah and Eshtaol, to spy out the land and search it. They said to them, go search the land. So they went to the mountains of Ephraim, to the house of Micah, and lodged there. What a coincidence. Here are these guys. Where are they coming from? They're coming from the same area that Samson was from. Same tribe. Samson was from the tribe of Dan. He was a Danite. Now these guys are off looking for more. I wonder if there was a connection. If this was before Samson, well, maybe that's why Samson turned out the way he did. If it was after Samson, well, maybe Samson influenced this. We don't know. But the reality is these people now are going out and find something more instead of trying to take what God had already given to them. They went to the mountains of Ephraim and lo and behold came to the house of Micah. While they were there at the house of Micah, they recognized the voice of the young Levite. How did they recognize the voice? Did they know him? Hey, what a coincidence, running into you here. Last time we saw you was in Bethlehem. Boy, it's good to see you. By his name, by the way, we find out later, is Jonathan, the Levite. John, how long has it been? Or maybe they just, some scholars believe that they just acknowledged that his accent, his dialect, was not from around there, was from the south, was from Bethlehem. And so they said, hey, what are you doing up here? So regardless, they kind of recognized him. They recognized the voice of the young Levite. There's an interesting word, young. Young Levite. Micah invited the young Levite to be his father. Do you see the pride of life there? Being exalted a little bit too quickly into a position where you don't really belong. And it's possible, and we're warned, actually, Paul warns Timothy, not to appoint anyone too soon, lest he fall into the same snare of the devil. A novice, he called him. And that novice can fall into the trap, the same trick of the devil, which was pride. That's what caused the devil to fall, pride. And a young man who's exalted too quickly can easily fall into the trap of pride. They turned aside and said to him, who brought you here? What are you doing in this place? What do you have here? And he said to them, thus and so Micah did for me. He has hired me, and I have become his priest. Hireling. He's hired me. I work for him. I tell him what he needs to hear. I tell him what he wants to hear. I work for him. My payroll comes from him. Everything that I have is from him. Him, 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 him. And when that happens, you cannot be objective. Can't be objective. You can't speak for God in that place because you may lose your job. That's not the way it's supposed to be. A man of God works for God, serves the Lord, and does what he has to speak on behalf of God. So they said to him, well, then please inquire of God that we may know whether the journey on which we go will be prosperous. And the priest said to him, go in peace. The presence of the Lord be with you on your way. That was mighty quick. Yeah, sure, whatever you want, just go. So the five men departed and went to Laish. They saw the people who were there, how they dwelt safely in the manner of the Sidonians, quiet and secure. There were no rulers in the land who might put them to shame for anything. They were far from the Sidonians, and they had no ties with anyone. Then the spies came back to their brethren at Zorah and Eshtaol, and their brethren said to them, what is your report? So they said, arise, let us go up against them, for we have seen the land, and indeed it is very good. Would you do nothing? Do not hesitate to go and enter to possess the land. You know, it's amazing how much confidence they have at this time. They should have had that much confidence in taking the land that was given to them in the first place. But suddenly they see these innocent, peaceful, docile people. Notice what it says about them. It says how they dwelt safely in verse 7, in the manner of the Sidonians, quiet and secure. Now they're looking at this land, this area, this region, and they're saying, wow, this is a paradise here. And when we were in Israel last month, we went to this area. We saw exactly what this talk. It was beautiful there. A lot of water, nice, lush greenery everywhere. It was a perfect location. And we also saw the area where they built the temple and created later on, years later, this is the area where the division of the nation took place, where they actually set up a second temple in violation to God's law. Yes, oh, it was a beautiful place, peaceful place, easy to take care of, easy to overcome. When you go, you will come to, listen, a secure people. And a large land, for God has given it into your hands, a place where there is no lack of anything that is on the earth. God has given it. That's a false assumption. Here are a harmless people. These people were not, when you talk about the secure people, they were the people who would cause Israel no harm. The ones who were in their territory that they were supposed to kick out, they were supposed to conquer and remove them, they were going to cause harm and did cause harm. These people were causing no harm to anybody. So this is where we see now, as I said earlier, the immorality, the social immorality, that they're going to do something to innocent people that they shouldn't do. And this was what happens once religion, once the God, the true God of Israel, the true God of Christianity is removed. Pretty soon social issues change. Morality becomes paramount in one's life. Immorality, I should say, it has its way and basically takes over a society. And 600 men of the family of the Danites went from there, from Zorah and Eshtaol, armed with weapons of war. Then they went up and encamped in Kirjath Jearim in Judah. For they call that place Mahana Dan to this day. There it is, west of Kirjath Jearim. And they passed from there to the mountains of Ephraim and came to the house of Micah by coincidence. Then the five men who had gone to spy out the country of Laish answered and said to their brethren, hey guys, did you know that there are in these houses an ephod, household idols, a carved image, and a molded image? Now therefore consider what you should do. Hey guys, what do you think about that? You know, we are going to establish a new place. We could use some of these things. So they turned aside there and came to the house of the young Levite man, the house of Micah, and greeted him. The 600 men, armed with their weapons of war, who were of the children of Dan, stood by the entrance of the gate. Now, quite a menacing visit, wouldn't you say? Then the five men who had gone to spy out the land went up. Entering there, they took the carved image, the ephod, the household idols, and the molded image. The priest stood at the entrance of the gate with the 600 men who were armed with weapons of war. When these went into Micah's house and took the carved image, the ephod, the household idols, and the molded image, the priest said to them, "What are you doing?" And they said to him, "Be quiet, put your hand over your mouth, and come with us. Be a father and a priest to us. Is it better for you to be a priest to a household of one man, or that you be a priest to a tribe and a family in Israel?" What is this? Promotion. This is a career move. This sounds great. Not to mention, if he didn't do it, they'd probably kill him. So he had all the incentive to go with these men. I mean, that makes sense, right? Look, you're going to sit here and pretend to be a priest over the family of one man? Or are you going to come with us? We're an entire tribe. We're the tribe of Dan. We're a whole people. You come and be our priest. Maybe I can get 2 suits of clothing out of this. There is definitely this sense of promotion that's taking place here. So, the priest's heart was glad. Wow. And he took the ephod, the household idol, and the ephod is actually that breastplate, and there would be, on that breastplate would be a couple of stones known as the Urim and the Thummim, and these were given to the high priest who was supposed to wear this in the presence of the Lord to be able to hear God's voice, to determine the will of the Lord. That's what that was for. Here he's got this ephod. And he took the ephod, he took the household idols, the carved image, and took his place among the people. Then they turned and departed and put the little ones, the livestock, and the goods in front of them. And they were a good way from the house of Micah. The men who were in the houses near Micah's house gathered together and overtook the children of Dan. And they called out to the children of Dan. So they turned around and said to Micah, "What ails you, that you have gathered such a company?" So he said, "You have taken away my gods, which I made, and the priest, and you have gone away. Now what more do I have? How can you say to me, 'What ails you?'" "Are you kidding me?" he says. "What do you mean, what ails me? Well, look what you've done. I made these gods. You took my gods away from me, and I've got nothing now." I wonder if he's being struck with the understanding of this as he's saying it. "I've got nothing. These gods I made, and you took them from me." Do you see how pointless that sounds? I mean, go home and make some more. There's nothing there anyway. There's no value in it other than the gold or the silver that you may have made them with. It's not a god that you can talk to. It's just a statue, a piece of wood, piece of metal. That's all it is. "They have ears," God said, "because you carved them. They have a mouth because you gave them mouths. But they can't speak to you. They can't hear you." This is the idea behind false religion, the foolishness of it, the silliness of it. That man would somehow think that he can fashion for himself a religion and somehow believe that it's going to sustain him in a time of trouble. It's impossible. You see, when he had the idols, when he had his beliefs, when he had his religion, he had nothing then. But now he thinks because it was taken from him that he has nothing now. He never had anything. He could have had all the idols in the whole region and still had nothing. It's a shame when we put our confidence or our security in a false teaching, in a false belief. It's so sad to find someone who has established their life on a doctrine that isn't true. a belief system that doesn't hold water, biblically speaking. And there are many, many, many well-intentioned believers who have fallen prey to some form of false doctrine or another. And so often when we think of false teaching, we think of the big organizations, the big religious groups, or we think of David Koresh, or we think of Jim Jones, or some radical, extreme cultish thing. But there are a lot of Christian groups that have some strange beliefs, and we buy into it, and it can be destructive to our spiritual life and livelihood. Issues on faith, issues on marriage and divorce, issues of morality versus immorality, issues of authority, pastoral abuse, so many things that people have encountered in so-called normal Christian churches. And it's very unfortunate that we buy into them. Then when it's taken away, our lives are destroyed and devastated. And the children of Dan said to him, "Do not let your voice be heard among us, lest angry men fall upon you and you lose your life with the lives of your household." Then the children of Dan went their way, and when Micah saw that they were too strong for him, he turned and went back to his house. "What ails you?" he says. He said, "Be quiet. Don't speak so loudly, lest these angry men come and destroy you and all your house. Just be glad we let you live. We're just taking your gods. You can go and make your own gods." So they took the things Micah had made and the priest who had belonged to him and went to Laish, to a quiet people and secure, and they struck them with the edge of the sword and burned the city with fire. You see, now, this is the murder of innocence. These people were quiet and secure. They were bothering nobody. This is murder. It's not war. God didn't tell them to do this. There was no deliverer because it was far from Sidon, and they had no ties with anyone. It was in the valley that belongs to Beth-Rehob, so they rebuilt the city and dwelt there. They called the name of the city Dan, after the name of Dan their father, who was born to Israel. However, the name of the city formerly was Laish. And the children of Dan set up for themselves the carved image. And Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh, and his sons were priests to the tribe of Dan until the day of the captivity of the land. So they set up for themselves Micah's carved image, which he made all the time that the house of God was in Shiloh. And all of this began because of 1,100 shekels that were stolen. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? Now, the door has opened to idolatry, and God would have to now judge his people because they carelessly let things into their lives that they shouldn't have let in. Let this be a lesson to us all, that we would not carelessly allow things into our lives that don't belong, whether they may be religious beliefs or moral temptation. Let us be careful to honor God in all that we do, that we would be careful not to allow spiritual infidelity into our lives, and that we would be careful in our morality, not. Well, when we get into next week, we'll see more about moral depravity as it really spirals out of control. But we see the lessons to learn here. God said, don't put idols up. They put idols up. And God tells us not to do something, it's best we don't. When he tells us to do something, it's best we do. So let's obey the Lord and honor him with our lives.